Welcome to a KMUD News special presentation of the California Department of Cannabis Control meeting at the Mateel Center from Wednesday, June 24th. You'll hear directly from notable local cannabis growers with responses provided by DCC Director Clint Kellum and his staff. And now, for this half hour, audio from the DCC meeting at the Mateel.
Hi, I'm Valerie White. You also mentioned the unannounced visits and what has happened with that, because we have locked gates, we have dogs, we have lives, you know, heaven forbid we get sick, we're out of town, you know, then we get violations and we're treated like criminals still.
So unannounced visits are not an attack on this community. They are a standard sort of regulatory tool that does avail the sort of department to be able to make sure that the licensee is doing what they're expected to be doing at all times. The products that we're working on do go into people's bodies down the road, and so it's important that it's not only when there's advance notice, but that all times that farms are operating with those sort of under those rules. And so that's the reason for it. In addition to, I'm gonna be really hunched over. I got a 4.5 hour drive home this evening. I'm gonna have a back problem at the end of this. But also the piece is that there's also a lot of, as you all are aware, inversion, diversion, sort of other activity that's perpetuating the illicit market and is not helping this legal market that is helped by not having unannounced visits. And I mean, I've heard varying stories of like whether you can clean something up or not. And like, if you don't have visible physical evidence, you're gonna have a really hard time proving something in administrative court. And so we can't just point to like, oh, well, something happened in Metric 24 hours ago, so I think it's fishy and I now want to suspend or take their license. That won't hold up for us in administrative court. And so it's actually having that element of readiness. You know, talking with our compliance team, it's a tough issue for them. They're driving hours. They don't want somebody to not be there as well. And when people say they're not there, I think I say this and I do mean it, like it is very difficult for our compliance staff to know who is well-intentioned and who is not well-intentioned. No one is clearly identifying themselves as such. And so when they go into a compliance visit, they just have to be vigilant about any of those things. And someone that says, oh, I'm not available for X or Y reasons, is, you know, somebody that's not well-intentioned could be using those same reasons. And so I think what I've heard in some places, there are areas of refinement. You know, if somebody is headed to Costco and they can take a picture of their receipt, that's evidence that within that date and timestamp they were at Costco, maybe we should be providing some leniency in those cases. I haven't, Aaron and Emerson may jump at me, but this is actually something I haven't talked with our deputy director about. But like, you know, I think that's worthy of a conversation. There will still be instances where we would provide a notice to comply and follow a progressive discipline process. Like if somebody's like continually, I'm not there. But we're also not looking out to try to have the element of surprise to make people's lives miserable. This is very common in regulated businesses, especially so in products that are going to in people's bodies or in areas of care where people have to be protected, sort of in elder care facilities. I'm absolutely sympathetic to the concern. I think though, when I think about what our role is, it would feel like we're being negligent to our job if we walked away from that as a compliance tool.
That's very understandable, but most of the time, even a 12-hour warning, there's not much we can do. You know, I mean, in my mind, I can't see much that could be changed or done in 12 hours, but we, for security reasons in the rural area, whether or not we're growing cannabis, need to have our gates locked. And so being able to have some way to prove when we are not there, to be able to still not have a violation and be in compliance, I think is important. And to not be treated as criminals when we're not, when we've worked so hard to not be.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to feel like they're being treated like criminals. My wife's a hairstylist, and the person that comes through to regulate her would come in unannounced as well. And I know she would be terrified from it, and feel like she's walking on pins and needles. And so it's a challenging thing on both sides. And I definitely have empathy for you all in that situation. This is your livelihood. This is how you pay your bills. You don't want some mistake to sort of drive the end of that or some financial ruin to you. And so when I talked with the compliance folks that were up here, I saw the same compassion in that engagement as well. And so that there isn't that animosity on the other side. Maybe there's a professional veneer of like, I'm here to do my work. I need to be professional. And sort of have that sort of line, but and I can understand that. I think I don't know that that is totally unreasonable. But is there room for improvement? Certainly. And like I mentioned, we'll go back and talk about like if there's evidence of clearly not being available, can we use that as a substitute for some grace? Right. It doesn't mean that the next time we're coming is announced. But it's sort of like, it doesn't need to lead into a progressive discipline process in those cases, right? And for sure, I don't want people living their lives with the shroud of concern. And I think also our folks seemed very willing and interested in alternative access to your facility, which I think comes with its own set of concerns of like, you don't want to allow the department access when you're not there. But if you were out of town or something and you had a neighbor that you could trust to allow access, that would be a way of sort of helping us have that opportunity to feel like we were accessing the facility. And then you being at peace while you're away, that you could sort of like rest that, you know, like you're not going to be caught up because you're not at the farm. So I feel like we could sort of troubleshoot along those lines, but walking away from it entirely, it doesn't feel possible at the moment given the sort of need for it within the compliance realm.
Johnny from Huckleberry Hill Farms. It's more for the enforcement. I apologize, I forgot your name. I guess my question is more along the lines is, I want you to be aware that you're sitting in a room with some of the smallest farmers in the state of California who are up against some of these big giant corporations, and we're having a really hard time surviving. So I guess my question is, especially for my farm and a lot of the small farms, is we're talking about a plant that grows at a different rate and different strains grows differently from year to year. And as we grow these different strains, we're held to a standard of a square footage, right? So in my personal situation, I'm always worried about my farm, maybe the plant's growing too fast and I exceed the allotted square footage of my farm, and the word embargo comes to mind because we've been hearing that a lot in this community. So one of my questions is, what dictates you embargoing a farm or certain situations on that farm? And as a small farmer, we just really want to be treated the same as some of these big farms. And we know that just even recently, there's been giant farms that have been caught with 100 illegal workers in them and a lot of other infractions, and not too much has happened to them. But when we have a plant that's a little bit bigger than we are, our whole farm gets embargoed. So that's it. Thanks.
So for an over canopy type situation like that, there's sort of two different variations. So one is, when you got the license, right, you set up these are my canopy areas and they may be beds or hoop houses or something. If you're still just using those designated areas and your plants have just, like you said, gotten big and went past those boundaries, but you haven't set up whole new additional canopy areas, we almost certainly wouldn't embargo that. It would be technically, again, we kind of have to interpret the regs literally there. It is a violation for exceeding it, but there's options for that, right? You can net it in or something like that. Where we would embargo is, say, you had 10 hoop houses that were approved for the canopy, and then you added two more. Those two ones that's like, this isn't on your diagram, this isn't approved, and you're beyond your limit, that's what we would embargo. But the rest, we'd be fine. And again, those ones where it's just exceeding it by like 6 inches all the way down the side, we wouldn't embargo, but we would kind of be like, okay, we'll have to find a solution that brings you into compliance on this. So that's that one. And then I guess, I mean, obviously I can't comment on any specific licenses or investigations, but we do are very mindful of applying these things equally. So in some ways, I know kind of Clint said, the unannounced inspections things, it happens all across the state, including to the big ones. And I would say if on a small farm, you run into an embargo situation and it's very impactful, imagine if you have 100 stacked small outdoor licenses and you didn't tag any of those and none of those were in metric, we're embargoing all of that too. So it's massive amounts. The bigger the farm, the regs apply the same. We apply, the consequences are the same. It just scales up even for them as well. So that's kind of all from the compliance division side I can promise, is that we do apply it equally. And the consequences are huge for some of the big operators who aren't following the same regulations. So hopefully that answers your questions. Yeah.
Hello, Thomas Mulder here. Lots of things. You say you don't treat us like a criminal. And I heard your first presentation of questions and answers back and forth with the first person, and it made me feel like a criminal. Never been actually arrested, been held at gunpoint by law enforcement for hours for operating a piece of equipment. The cops are there to just get and eat the weed and two mushrooms. So from the way I feel, I don't feel that you're hearing us. These are our homes. I've had so many traumatic life things happen, as well as everyone in this room. These are our homes that you're coming to. I've had armed people show up at my gate. So I've slept with a loaded gun to make sure I didn't get my crop robbed. So I want you to think about that when you're showing up to these places unannounced. I think the respect, we have respect. We email, hey, this is Inspector A and B. They're gonna show up. They're gonna be here on this day. So that way we know we can verify technically, hey, it really is that person. It's not someone that got some clothing. So I just, like, I want you to really understand that these are our homes. There's parts of our property that are our homes and our private residence. You don't belong there. And like, it's just, I'm really passionate about that. So I want you to hear that. I think that's the most important thing for everyone in this room. Hear us. No unannounced visits. I've been saying this for years. I met with Nicole Elliott 2 years ago, Chris Nevidal, and two other people. I was given a handshake promise in April of 24, no more tagging. You know what's compliance that she said? Put them at the end of the greenhouse. As long as the plant count matches, we're good. Here we are, what, June 26? We don't have that change of batch tagging. People don't have the labor costs because you guys did not invoke the 1 acre cap. So, hey, do you want to allow our 5-year-old kids and grandchildren to apply the tags to the plants to make you guys feel warm and fuzzy inside? Or are you okay with us putting them at the edge of the greenhouses? There's 500 plants in this greenhouse. There's 500 tags right there. So that's where I'm coming from. I have a couple more things, but I want to hear a couple responses.
Yeah. I definitely think like the historical context and how cannabis was treated in this area certainly layers on to how we're interacting and how that makes you feel. And I can do nothing but sort of provide empathy in that situation and say that I understand and I realize that that's difficult. When I work with the humans on the other side of this, they're humans, that they are not walking around saying these are a bunch of criminals. They were like, yeah, this is really difficult. Like, you know, we had to make a tough decision on somebody and take their livelihood. And it was very impactful. So that's hard on that side too. But it doesn't mean like I said at the beginning, unannounced inspections are important for having a robust compliance regime for products that humans are going to ingest that is fairly overrun with inversion and diversion and not knowing who those people are. And so we just can't walk away from that right now. And I understand that that is not what anybody in this room wants to hear. It's if I could tell you the sugar-coated story of we would walk away from it, I would gladly do so. I just feel like we wouldn't be doing our jobs without that. Group tagging, I can tell you, is publicly available and in the works, so it is going to happen. It's about when now. I'm sorry it took so long. Working in government is a highly constrained environment. It's like driving like an oil tanker. We don't turn quickly. There's always like, in group tagging in particular, it turned out we needed more state law changes than we realized, and those were accommodated in last year's Assembly Bill 8 bill, which allowed us to move that over the line. So I apologize that we can't be sort of more accommodating on that issue. I realize they're your homes. I've been at people's homes this week. I love that. I love that for people that want to have that opportunity. But this is sort of the regulated world, and we do have to allow those pieces. We are also instituting some training for like de-escalation and verbal communication to try to sort of like where people that don't have the appropriate communication styles can dial that down and be able to deal with situations. Like, it's tense on your side, it's tense on our side too. Like, I mean, I've been out there with compliance staff. You know, they don't want to overrun somebody into their facility. Like, that's uncomfortable for them. And so it's a tense situation. So we're trying to provide some training and improvement on our end to give our folks tools. So I think that's my response.
Good afternoon. My name is Nathan. I have a small farm in Ferndale, Ladybug Herbal Sanctuary, and I'm only here to talk about inspections. No, I'm just kidding. There's a lot more to talk about. I've paid a lot of money for the right to do what I do. And I've agreed with your agency that I will do metric within 3 days. I will disclose my change in DRP and contact within 14 days. Me and everyone in here, we're trying our best and we're committed to these timelines, rules, compliance, measures that we've agreed to live under. One of the frustrations that I have is when I submit a response or I make a phone call, hey, you'll get called back in 24 hours. 3 days later, I might get a call back. If I make a change to my DRP, I might get an email in 3 months. I might get a couple follow-ups 2 months after that. So my question is pretty simple. Now that you're running the agency, and I know that you've done a lot of, I mean, being here is a great step, outreaching, hearing what we're dealing with. What are you doing internally to hold your department heads, employees accountable? And what steps can we take short of calling you, hey Clint, I got a problem, I need your help. Like, are there any mechanisms you're building in to help ratchet something up if it needs more guidance or more looking, flag something, timely responses? I wanna hear a little bit about what you're doing within the agency to help respect our rights and help us do our job better so we can all move forward with purpose.
Yeah, I mean, at the macro level, we're all of our deputy directors of each of our divisions are establishing key performance indicators that are sort of like their focus on how we move forward on our overarching goal. And sort of we're in the process of building that out with a new strategic plan, not overbuilding them and keeping ourselves sort of like very focused because we've got a big problem, and sort of like scope creep in my mind is one way that you sort of lose momentum. But I think you've made this comment when we were interacting on Monday, and Michael maybe could speak a little bit to sort of like turnaround times with staff, and Aaron, you too, and compliance. But it did.
Yeah, I just want to put Michael on the spot here.
So. Yeah, no, that's good. Let's get him on the spot. But it did strike me that I wanted to go back and talk with our executive team to make sure that we do sort of have clear rules about like communicating back with folks when we can, and try to humanize the situation the best we can. I will say that in my mind that there is some friction with that. We have almost 600 people. So when you institutionalize something like that, it's not like, oh, everybody respond quickly and be nice is gonna work. And then you start building in a policy for that, and then you need to do this policy, and then it's like, are we actually getting to the goal of having a legal market that functions for small cultivators? And so I definitely want to go back and have the conversation, but I am sort of leery of like establishing 24-hour turnaround timelines or those types of things, because what if that eats into something that's more important that's on that person's plate today, which is kind of goes back into the key performance indicator piece of like, those are the mountains we need to move, and I want us hyper-focused on that. In a host of things, I meet with every division either bi-weekly with our compliance team, meeting with all like the supervisors and executives within that division and sort of getting a read out of what's going on. And so more at the macro level. And then from time to time, as cases sort of like get more sticky, they move up usually between compliance and legal is very sort of like tight in those communications. And if anything ever needs to bubble up, they engage me as needed. I won't say that happens very frequently, because they're able to sort of discern those pieces and they know sort of where we sit on this continuum. But I don't, Michael, if you want to chime in on sort of response time.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you guys know, for the last few years, we've been focused mostly on transition provisional to annuals. That's kind of where heavy workload is for licensing divisions. And in order for us to really tackle those transitions, we structure differently than how we are structuring now, right? The focus was that we have a specialized group on modifications, special group on transitions, and special group on new application review. And we realized that, and I keep on getting feedback all the time, that like, hey, I have to talk to 3-4 people to get a response to my license. Who do I talk to? So just this year, earlier this year, we complete overhaul licensing divisions, where we start assigning case owners. So from now on, each licensee will have a dedicated case owner that will handle all their inquiries from new application coming in, owner modifications, premises diagram changes, or DRP changes, so that you will be able to have a single point of contact all the way. We just start implementing on May 1st, so it might take a minute for you guys to actually encounter or receive an email or notify who that case owner is, but that's something that we are also trying to do. But also keep in mind, we have right now 34 licensing analysts, and we have 7,500 licensees out there. So each of the analysts are tackling about 280 to 300 licenses. So obviously, I'm trying to work, like Glenn said, come up with a KPI, so like a reasonable turnaround time, and I will make sure that my team are by those days, but 24-hour turnaround time might not be feasible just because of the number of licensees that we have.
How's it going? I'm Indy Riggs. I'm a local cannabis farmer here in Humboldt County. I also serve on the board of directors for the Humboldt County Growers Alliance. First of all, thank you guys for coming here. I know it's not easy to come and sit in front of a bunch of people and talk and answer questions, so kudos to you guys for being able to do that. We really appreciate it. There's probably 100 different questions I can ask, but none that you guys would be able to provide an answer to that would make everybody in this room feel better, unfortunately. I think a lot of these things that people are bringing up, the questions they're asking, the issues they're bringing up, all boil down to what is occurring in the industry, which is consolidation. And it's occurring at a more rapid rate. My concerns are these unannounced inspections, broader enforcement action, new regulations that are being released are encouraging that consolidation, and maybe the department might be feeling some pressure to spur that along. So going back, one thing that kind of contributes to that concern is recent proposed regulations for changes to the track and trace program, which were released on June 5th, explicitly state things along those lines, how these regulations will f- favor larger operators, more well-funded operations, and disenfranchise small farms and small operators. Doesn't seem to be a problem within the department. So after reading that, I went ahead and brought up the harvest report from 2024, California Cannabis Harvest Report for 2024 was released in March of 2025. And there's numerous sections throughout this report that states exactly that, that consolidation is good for the cannabis industry. It brings costs down, it brings economies to scale, and you know, makes it easier to regulate. So that's also concerning to me, and also provides evidence to this concern. Is glaringly missing from this harvest report are the impacts to small farms and small farmers, and the impacts to our communities, rural economies. They're hurting, not just cannabis farmers, but our entire communities are hurting because of this. So a question and a recommendation. One, I love that this is happening. We would all like to see more of this, more education, less enforcement, more of a collaborative relationship to help small businesses, small family farms succeed in this environment of consolidation. Two, the next harvest report that I was thinking would have been released by now, but it's not, would be amazing to see some analysis on what this consolidation, the impacts it has, not just on small farmers, but on our communities, on Humboldt County, on Trinity County, Mendocino County. This is about a lot more than the cannabis market crash to us. It's about the crashing of our communities. So that's what we're feeling. We feel that anytime we get, you know, inspections, the no-knock inspections, the unannounced inspections, it's not just PTSD from being legacy operators, but it's, are we gonna be able to keep doing this? Is this just the way it's gonna be? When Governor Newsom was here with his big meeting, there are a lot more people in this room. Most of those people are no longer here. They're gone, they're out of business. People have, you know, died by suicides, all sorts of things. So this is the real thing that we're dealing with, corporate consolidation. And so my question is, does the department endorse a policy that helps perpetuate this consolidation?
I don't think that in there it is saying that we favor big operators over small operators, because that's not true. There's never a moment in our department where we're like, yes, we want to favor the large operators over the small operators. I've never heard that uttered in my 18 months at the department. And so I do sit with the folks that are making the policy changes at the department, so I can feel fairly confident on that. The market report does speak in general economic terms, and industries have normal economic patterns within them, and new industries see a lot of what we saw within the cannabis market, where you see a heavy flow of entrants to begin with, and then you see consolidation over time. So it's not showing a preference for it, it's just stating what happens. And there's not a market for small farmers and big farmers. There's a market for both, ultimately, downstream. There are price-conscious consumers that aren't going to be able to sort of appreciate the sort of quality and nuance that your products may provide over sort of like a scaled cultivator that may not produce all of the benefits of a small farmer's cannabis. And so ultimately, that there is a market where that does exist. And then there's a market that still has adherence to the craft small cultivator that has a consumer base that cares.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is how industry works. We just had an opportunity to do something different in California with cannabis. And unfortunately, it's going the same direction that the rest of rural America has gone.
Thanks for listening to our KMUD News special presentation of the California Department of Cannabis Control meeting at the Mateel Center with local growers. We have also uploaded this recording, which can be found on Facebook or Instagram under @KMUDNews. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.